Thinking about Cordwainer Smith. Written for the program booklet of the annual science fiction conference ReaderCon of July 1994, this essay was aimed at a sophisticated group of readers familiar with its subject. For those who haven't read the fiction of Cordwainer Smith or James Tiptree Jr., I can only hope it may awaken a curiosity that will lead them to have a look at the works of these intensely original writers. Some points will be clearer if one knows that both writers worked for the U.S. government, the usual explanation of why they used pen names when they wrote fiction, and that Smith, as Paul Leinbarger, was a professor of Asiatic studies at Johns Hopkins, an intelligence agent in China during the Second World War, wrote Psychological Warfare, long the standard text on the subject, served as a member of the Foreign Policy Association and advisor to John F. Kennedy, and was Sun Yat-sen's godson. Names. A pen name is a curious device. Actors, singers, dancers use stage names for various reasons, but it seems that not many painters or sculptors or composers make up their name. If you're a German composer named Engelbert Humperdinck, who wrote the opera Hansel and Gretel, you don't do anything about your name, you just live with it. Till 100 years later, some dweeb singer comes along and filches it because he thinks it's cute. If you're a French painter named Rosa Bonheur, you don't call yourself Georges Tristesse, you just paint horses and sign Rosa, large and clear. But writers, especially fiction writers, are always making up names. Do they confuse themselves with their characters? The question isn't totally frivolous. I think most novelists are aware at times of containing multitudes, of having an uncomfortably acute sympathy for multiple personality disorder, of not entirely subscribing to the common sense notion of what constitutes a self. And there is a distinction, normally, between the writer and the person. The cult of personality erases this difference, with writers like Lord Byron and Hemingway. As with actors or politicians, the person disappears in the glare of the persona. Publicity, book tours, and so on all keep the glare focused. People line up to meet the writer, not realizing that this is impossible. Nobody can be a writer during a book signing, not even Harlan Ellison. All they can write is, "To Jane Doe with best regards from George Author," not a very interesting story. All their admirers can meet is the person, who has a lot in common with, but is not, the writer. Maybe nicer, maybe duller, maybe older, maybe meaner, but the main difference is the person lives in this world, but writers live in their imagination, and or in the public imagination, which creates a public figure that lives only in the public imagination. So the pen name, hiding the person behind the writer, may be essentially a protective and enabling device, as it was for the Bronte sisters, and for Marianne Evans. The androgynous Currer, Ellis, and Acton Bell hid Charlotte, Emily, and Anne Bronte from a publicity that might offend their small community, and also gave their manuscripts a chance to be read with an unprejudiced eye by editors who would assume them to be men. George Eliot protected Marianne Evans, who was unrepentantly living in sin, from the dragon of social disapproval. I think one can assume that these personae also allowed the writers a freedom from inner censors, internalized shames and inhibitions, notions of what a woman should write. The masculine pen name, oddly enough, frees the woman author from obedience to a masculine conception of literature and experience. I think James Tiptree Jr. undoubtedly gave Alice Sheldon such freedom. But with Sheldon, we come to another aspect of the pen name, the already public figure who wants or needs a different persona for a different kind of work. I don't know if there was any actual professional need for Sheldon to be Tiptree. Would she have lost a job or come under governmental suspicion if she'd published her stories under her own name? My guess is that her need for the pen name was primarily and intensely personal. She needed to write as somebody other than who she was. She had led a highly successful career as a woman, but as a writer, she needed, at least at first, to present herself perhaps even to herself, as a man. She found her alter ego on the label of a jar of marmalade. She slipped into the impersonation very comfortably, writing not only stories but letters as James Tiptree Jr., who became a beloved, treasured pen friend to many people. When she began to want to publish as a woman, she used only half of her own name, calling herself Racuna Sheldon, a name that troubles me, because the invented half is so grotesque that it seems a self-put-down. Finally, when they blew her cover, she essentially stopped writing. It looks as if the name/mask, whether masculine or feminine, was above all an enabler to her, an escape route from a public self that could not or would not write into a private self that was all writer. So how about Professor and Colonel Paul Myron Anthony Linebarger? What was Cordwainer Smith to him? From here on, I rely completely and gratefully on the researches of John J. Pierce, the prime authority on Linebarger/Smith's life and writing. In his fine introduction to The Rediscovery of Man, Pierce tells us that Linebarger published his book on psychological warfare under his own name, but his first two novels, Rhea and Corolla, as Felix C. Forrest. Then, when people found out who Forrest was, he couldn't write anymore. That sounds like Sheldon. Pierce goes on, he tried a spy thriller, Atomsk, as Carmichael Smith, but was found out again. He even submitted a manuscript for another novel under his wife's name, but nobody was fooled. Using your wife's name as an alias implies to me not only a very good-natured wife, but a very imperative need for a mask. It also implies a quite extraordinary indifference to what is so often of immense importance to a man, that he be perceived always and totally as a man. My guess is that the pen name he finally settled on may have been necessary to save his dignity as an academic and an expert on grave matters, but was equally important to him because it allowed him psychic freedom. Dr. Linebarger had to be respectable and responsible and had to guard his tongue. Cordwainer Smith wrote skiffy and babbled whatever he pleased. The doctor used his knowledge discreetly to counsel Chiang Kai-shek and advise politicians and diplomats. Mr. Smith let that knowledge out in the open to please the common folk who read popular fiction and to serve art. Paul was a man. Cordwainer was men, women, animals, a cosmos. Splitting the personality in this way might signify in most people that they were a bit daft, but all the writers I've been talking about were notably effective people in both incarnations, flesh and paper. Still, their paper selves, having long outlived the real person, might well ask, which of us can claim to be real? Words. After all, fiction writers make a reality of words. The arts of writing all begin in playing with words, wallowing in them, reveling in them, being obsessed by them, finding reality in them. Words are the mud this mud pie's made of. Some writers are cool and masterful and never get their hands dirty, but Cordwainer Smith got muddy from the toes to the top of the head. Language evidently intoxicated him and sometimes controlled him. Rhymes, particularly, and the rhythms of sentences. Golden the ship was. Oh, oh, oh. That's the last line and the title of one of his stories. I have a baseless, unverifiable, perhaps totally mistaken conviction that the line came before the story. That the story grew out of, unfolded from, was compelled to exist by an unexplained, unattached fragment of language, 7 words that took hold of his mind and rocked it and wouldn't let him be until he had made a box of meaning that would hold them. Golden the ship was. Oh, oh, oh. This kind of thing is part of his peculiar magic. He knows a powerful phrase or word when he finds one and uses and repeats it powerfully. I suspect the instrumentality was very little but a word at first, a grand word, which, as he used, repeated, explored, explained it, turned out to contain in itself much of the wonderful, semi-coherent future history of the stories and the novel. The instrumentality of mankind. It is a suggestive, complex, multiplex kind of phrase, a mother-lode phrase that keeps leading to the high-grade ore. Sometimes I think the words get away from him. The story Drunk Boat is Arthur Rimbaud getting high on absinthe, getting Cordwainer Smith high on Le Bateau Ivre, and sailing out across the galaxy. It's a tour de force, but it's full of awfully bad verse. Point your gun at a murky lurky. Now you're talking ham or turkey. Shoot a shot at a dying owl, Dad. Don't ask the lady why or how, Dad. Lord Crudelta, in the story, quotes this as an example of words remaining long after their reference are gone, laboriously explaining that an owdad was an ancient sheep and that he doesn't know what ham and turkey were, but that children have sung the song for thousands of years. Well, I don't believe it. No sane child would sing that for 5 minutes. I think Cordwainer Smith had that stupid owdad howdad rhyme in his head and couldn't get it out, and it overcame his better reason and forced itself into the story. When you let words take you over, as Rimbaud and Smith did, you relinquish control to a sometimes dangerous extent. You can't keep the stupidities and inconsequentialities out the way a tight control writer can. You're on a wild ride and you have to take what comes. What comes may be treasure and may be junk. I find much of Drunk Boat overwritten, straining for effect, starting with its rather pompous claims to fame. Perhaps it is the saddest, maddest, wildest story in the whole long history of space. We know his name now, and our children and their children will know it for always. And the story is full of obsessive jingles, Bader Gator and Ochre Joker and so on, which weaken what should be a stunning effect when Rimbaud bursts into a wild flood of rhyming speech. There are too many one-sentence paragraphs, italics, and other heavy devices to show significance, and yet, what a wonderful image. The man swimming slowly through space-time, reaching through the walls, seeking his Elizabeth. And the recurrent characters, Sir and Dr. Vomacht, the Lord Crudelta, whose Italian name means what Lord Jesticott's means in Russian, the instrumentality itself. Drunk Boat is a wild jungle of language, grotesque, deformed, obstructive, energetic, vividly alive. The Mouse. I seem to be impelled to discuss stories that I don't particularly like, instead of the ones I love, such as Alpha Ralpha Boulevard, The Dead Lady of Clowntown, Mark Elf, A Planet Named Sheol. A Smith story that I have always resisted, kept my distance from, is Think Blue, Count Two. When I reread it some while ago for consideration for the Norton Book of Science Fiction, I saw again what I disliked. A pretty girl, blue-eyed, called Doll and Kitten. A plot that teases by threatening sadism, but dodges the threat by rather implausible means. And a sentimental ending where the doll kitten goes off with the deformed sadist, now miraculously cured and tamed. A very, very romantic story, plunging, as romanticism will, from sappy sweetness to sick cruelty with not much actual humanity in between. When it came to choosing for the Norton book, I wanted Alpha Ralpha Boulevard, which uses these characteristic Smithian themes in a story that is not excessively but magnificently romantic. A beautiful, powerful story. When my co-editors argued for other choices, I whined. I wanted Alpha Ralpha in that book the way I wanted Fritz Lieber's The Winter Flies in it, passionately, because to me they are uniquely valuable, unsurpassed explorations of regions of fiction that are still unfamiliar, still newfound lands. Well, so then I reread Think Blue again for this paper. I did so looking for evidence, as it were, of what I don't like in Smith. Served me right. What I found was that I had misread and underestimated the story shamefully. Indeed, the heroine, Doll Kitten, seems the typical male fantasy girl, virginal, beautiful, defenseless, with no skill, no learning, no trained capacities. No threat to nobody, no sir. She's being used to hold the crew together during a long voyage. She has daughter potential. That is, every man will want to protect her. She will keep everybody alive for her sake. However, in case things get really bad, she has another protection aboard in the form of one of Smith's unforgettable inventions, a cube of laminated mouse brain. We stiffened it with CelluPrime, and then we veneered it down about 7,000 layers. Each one has plastic of at least 2 molecular thicknesses. This mouse can't spoil. As a matter of fact, this mouse is going to go on thinking forever. He won't think much unless we put the voltage on him, but he'll think. And he can't spoil. I told you, this mouse is going to be thinking when the last human being on the last known planet is dead. And it's going to be thinking about that girl. Forever. The mouse does protect her, through the projection of various fantasies, which I no longer find as implausible as I did, because I now see that, in fact, she is protectable. She is not the inevitable victim I took her for. VC has strength and courage. She meets the danger posed by her psychotic male companions with stoicism. Life's life, she thought, and I must live it. Here. Her reaction to her own daughter potential is stoical endurance. Is it child again? She thought to herself. She's a woman, not a child, and she knows it if they don't. She is, in fact, remarkably like some of Dickens's much-ridiculed heroines, Lizzie Hexham, Amy Dorrit, Florence Dombey, who, though the male characters see them as childish and many readers follow suit, are in fact strong, courageous, adult women, survivors against all odds. She is childlike only in the depths of her innocence. At the most frightening moment, she asks the rapist, "Is this what crime is, what you are doing to me?" But the allegory is of an innocence stronger than experience, of a genuinely inviolable soul. And the sick bits, I now realize, are not self-indulgent, as so much literary rape and torture is. Trying to say something seriously about who men are, what their chief problem may be, Smith found these were the images to say it with, the necessary vocabulary. The apparitions summoned by Shasan to save Visi from the men and the men from themselves are much more complicated and psychologically tricky than I had thought. Since they bring about the happy ending, they can partake in high comedy, and they do, especially the last one, the ship's captain. If I stop to think about it, I find myself pretty upsetting. I know that I'm just an echo in your minds, combined with the experience and wisdom which has gone into the cube, so I guess that I do what real people do. I just don't think about it very much. I mind my business. He stiffened and straightened and was himself again. My own business, he repeated. And Shasan, said Treese, how do you feel about him? A look of awe, almost a look of terror, came upon the captain's face. Shasan, he is the thinker of all thinking, the to-be of being, the doer of doings. He is powerful beyond your strongest imagination. He makes me come living out of your living minds. In fact, said the captain with a final snarl, he is a dead mouse brain laminated with plastic, and I have no idea at all of who I am. Good night to you all. The captain set his cap on his head and walked straight through the hull. This reality shifting also contains one of Smith's central and, to me, most fascinating themes, that of the animal as savior. The engineer who created the cube imprinted his own personality in it. The minds of the girl and the two men create the apparitions. The girl's imprinted call for help switches on the voltage that activates the cube. But the saving energy lies, finally, in the brain of a dead mouse. The mouse is worth remembering. the under people. It's easy to remember Smith's great under people savior figures. Dijon, the dog woman, the pure sacrificial figure. E. Telly Kelly, man and eagle who flies deep under old earth, and of course, threading her way like a wandering red flame through the stories and the novel, Simmel, the girly girl, all woman and all cat. In stories where animal and human are mixed in the way Smith mixed them, the human body dominating but possessing animal characteristics, the effect is usually horrible or pitiful, the Minotaur or the awful creatures of Dr. Moreau's island. Here is Bidikot, the cattle person of Sheol, Smith's version of the Minotaur. An enormous face, four times the size of any human face Mercer had ever seen, was looking down at him. Huge brown eyes, cow-like in their gentle inoffensiveness, moved back and forth as the big face examined Mercer's wrapping. The face was that of a handsome man of middle years, clean-shaven, hair chestnut brown, with sensual, full lips and gigantic but healthy yellow teeth exposed in a half-smile. The face saw Mercer's eyes open and spoke with a deep, friendly roar. The mixture is very strange and not horrible at all. The bull and the man are each there, blended but uncontaminated, with their own nature and their own beauty. When human and animal can mix so completely, they are, by implication, the same. An identity has been asserted. In Norstrilia, the eponymous setting of Smith's one novel, an immortality drug, Stroon, or the Santa Clara drug, is made from the exudations of enormous, sick sheep. The countryside is dotted with these sheep, big as airplane hangars, immobile, diseased. By their endless dying, they furnish untold wealth and eternal life to their human owners. Animal sacrifice is a very widespread human custom. The little dead mouse, the dying sheep of Norstrilia, may be seen as animal sacrifices to ensure human welfare. But the underpeople's suffering and their sacrifice in the person of Dijon extend and enlarge the theme. It is unmistakably a human sacrifice, also a fairly widespread human custom. Dijon's life points to Joan of Arc, of course, and behind that, to the humiliation and death of Jesus. The old strong religion, one of Smith's fine phrases, is mentioned in several stories, but he never does much with it. In a way, it would seem more appropriate if the old strong religion were not Christianity, as it evidently is, but Buddhism. The compassionate Buddha can be incarnated as any creature, as a mother tiger, as a little jackal, as a bird, as a mouse. Smith does not share the Judeo-Christian exclusive focus on one species, the exclusion from sacredness of everything but the human. His stories say that the death of an animal counts the same, weighs the same, as the death of a human, that animal and human are equally sacred, that salvation can lie in the death of a dog as in the death of a god. This is pretty subversive stuff. Smith's attitude towards authority is complex. He loves to tell us about people who are immensely powerful and supernally rich, the lords and ladies of the instrumentality, the misters and owners of Norstrilia, such as the boy who bought old earth. Leinbarger's familiarity with the corridors of power must have fed this fascination, and also fueled Smith's visions of people in power who learn to be worthy of their power, who become just, compassionate, and wise. Their wisdom leads them to subvert their own orderly, static, perfect society, to reinvent freedom, ordaining the rediscovery of man when, everywhere, men and women worked with a wild will to build a more imperfect world. But wisdom, compassion, and justice fail them when it comes to the underpeople. Here they still have something to learn. Here the Judeo-Christian division still obtains. The underpeople are non-people. They have no rights, no souls. They are things that exist to serve man. Like any machine or slave, if useless or rebellious, they are to be destroyed. At this point, in this division, lies the ethical crux of Smith's strongest stories. Alpha Ralpha Boulevard serves well to illustrate the themes. In a corridor under the Earth, the 12-mile-high Earthport and the deep underground are recurrent, contrasted loci. The narrator Paul and his Virginia are threatened by a monstrous, Dr. Moreau-ish, drunken version of the Bull Man. They are saved from it by a woman who tells them, "Come no closer, I am a cat." When Paul thanks her and asks her name, she says, "Does it matter? I'm not a person." Paul has reacted to her as to a beautiful woman, but Virginia feels dirtied by even this contact with an underperson. At the end, high on the ruined boulevard in the sky, Simmel tries again to save them both. Virginia, horrified that a cat girl might actually touch her, tries to avoid her and falls to her death. Only Paul, who saw her as human, can be saved. And the reason she wanted to save them was that Paul, unthinkingly, instinctively, had stopped another man from crushing the eggs of some birds. "You saved them. You saved their young when the red-topped man was killing them all. All of us have been worried about what you true people would do to us when you were free. We found out. Some of you are bad and kill other kinds of life. Others of you are good and protect life." Thought I, is that all there is to good and bad? There is, of course, much more to the story, a marvelously complex one, but at the heart of it is this motif, a familiar one from our secular mythology, our folk tales. The girl who saves the ant from the spider's web is saved in turn by the ants, who do her impossible task for her. The prince who sneers at the wolf in the trap is lost in the forest, but the prince who frees the wolf inherits the kingdom. The theme is pagan, entering Christianity only with St. Francis. It is a profound element of Buddhism, Jainism, and other Asian religions, and the sense of the interdependence of human and animal is fundamental to the native religions of North America. Smith was touching a deep chord here, one that is not often struck in realistic fiction. Science fiction is specifically suited to this theme, since its central subject is the interaction of the human with the non-human, the known slash self with the unknown slash other. The durable and mysterious power of Cordwainer Smith's stories is not a matter only of their exuberant language and brilliant invention and hallucinatory imagery. There is a deep ground to them, a moral ground, lying in his persuasive conviction of the responsibility of one being for another. Thought I, is that all there is to good and bad? Note, Cordwainer Smith's works, published in paperback, are at any given moment mostly out of print. Among them are the story collections You Will Never Be the Same, Space Lords, Star Dreamer, and various combinations of pieces of what never quite became a finished novel, published under the titles The Planet Buyer, Quest of the Three Worlds, and Nostralia.